It's a question we get from time to time. Is online banking a good thing? Hi, I'm Rob West. If you're still using the drive-through window at your local bank branch to deposit checks and do other routine banking chores, you really should look into doing more of your banking online to save time and gas. We'll talk about it today, and then it's on to your calls at 800-525-7000. That's 800-525-7000. This is Faith and Finance Live, biblical wisdom for your financial decisions. Once upon a time, going to the bank was a regular part of life in America, but online banking has made most trips to your local branch unnecessary. By the way, there's a difference between online banking and online banks. Online banking is something you can do these days with almost any brick-and-mortar bank or credit union, although features and services will certainly vary from one financial institution to the other. Online banks, of course, have no brick-and-mortar branches. They're online only. And with the exception of the ATM networks they use, all transactions with them are online. Okay, that's the difference between online banks and online banking. But the reality is, that difference is getting smaller and smaller. The online features of brick-and-mortar banks really do rival anything that online-only banks have. Still, some folks are wondering if we simply won't need brick-and-mortar banks someday. We're probably a long way from that. People still need services that only brick-and-mortar banks can provide, like businesses that have to deposit coins and currency. You can't do that online. There are still 77,500 bank branches in the U.S. That sounds like a lot, but it's actually 12,500 fewer than 5 years ago. As more and more people do their banking online, traditional banks find they need fewer and fewer branches. You've probably noticed some of them closing in your area. We'll probably always need brick-and-mortar banks, just fewer of them. So with both online banks and online banking, it doesn't matter where your bank is, and it also doesn't matter where you are. You can do almost everything that needs doing on your computer or smartphone. Now that's convenience. Just don't ever use public Wi-Fi for your banking or any financial transaction. It's just too easy for hackers to steal your personal information. Now, there's another huge advantage of online banking that few people really think about. If it doesn't matter where the financial institution is, you have the opportunity to select any bank or credit union for your banking needs. You may have chosen a certain bank because they have many branches or even one branch conveniently located along your way home from work. Direct deposit long ago removed the need to stop and deposit a paycheck, but now you can deposit any check with your smartphone. You might ask then, is there really much of a difference between banks? Aren't they all pretty much the same? Actually, no. Wouldn't it be great to know that your financial institution is supporting Christian values and making a positive change in the world, in addition to providing great service? Wouldn't you want to put people over profit? Not that profit is bad, but it can't be the only priority. Stewardship is about 100% of what God gives us, not just the 10% in the offering plate. What if you could find and support institutions that are faith-based, whose mission is to help Christ followers live and give more abundantly? Online banking can give you faith-aligned options once you choose an institution that aligns with your values. There are a number of great faith-aligned banks and credit unions available today. One example is Christian Community Credit Union, an underwriter of this program. CCCU offers online banking so they can be accessed from anywhere in the country, and they're just a great example of how our banking decisions can make a positive impact for the kingdom. CCCU has donated over $6 million to ministry and mission projects in the U.S. and around the world. And they're using banking to leverage the money their members deposit with them to help construct new church buildings, expand ministries, and help Christian business owners thrive. So if you're looking for a faith-based banking solution that aligns with your beliefs and values, I'd encourage you to consider Christian Community Credit Union. Plus, each account is insured up to $250,000 by ASI. You can find out more at joinchristiancommunity.com. That's joinchristiancommunity.com. By the way, you can find institutions that align with your values in other financial areas as well. In fact, if you'd like to align your values with your investment decisions, we have a whole host of organizations that are underwriters of faith and finance that you can find on our website at faithfi.com. Just click on the show. That's faithfi.com. All right, your calls are next. 800-525-7000. We'll be right back.
The opinions offered during this program represent the personal or professional opinions of the participants, given for informational purposes only. Any information provided is not intended to replace advice from a financial, medical, legal, or other professional who understands your specific situation.
Well, I'm so glad you're along with us today on Faith and Finance Live here on Moody Radio. I'm Rob West. We've got some lines open today, although the calls are coming in quickly. The lines are filling. We'd love to hear from you, though. So call right now with your questions on anything financial. The number, 800-525-7000. Again, that's 800-525-7000. We'd like to dive into whatever you're thinking about in your financial life, help you process it through the lens of Scripture and make a great decision so you can move forward with confidence. We started today by talking about the advantages of online banking. I know this has gained in popularity over the years, and of course, we drew the distinction between online banks and online banking, where you transact business online, whether or not you have a brick or mortar bank. And there are clear advantages, but you need to be on your guard. We're seeing a significant rise in the number of fraudulent activities related to online transactions. And so just be sure you're checking those reports regularly at annualcreditreport.com. Be sure you're logging into your financial accounts to look for suspicious information. Enable two-factor authentication. Don't do business on public Wi-Fi. Change those passwords regularly and make them at least 10 characters long. And then finally, don't click those links in emails or ever give out information over the phone to somebody who's contacting you, regardless of who they say they represent. And if we do those things, we at least put ourselves in a position to protect ourselves from some of these more notorious fraudulent activities going on out there. So just be on your guard. We'll help you along the way. But looking forward to diving into your questions today. So let's do that now. We're going to begin today in Mason City, Iowa, with Diana. Go right ahead.
Yes, thank you, Rob, for taking my call. But we have some questions here about putting beneficiaries on our properties and other financial things. And we were wondering especially about our home deeds that we have. Do we need a lawyer to draw up another deed listing our transfer on death beneficiaries on our deeds?
Yeah, is this for a home that you own in the state of Iowa?
Yes, it is a home we have here in the state of Iowa, and we also have a rental property.
Okay. Yeah, unfortunately, the state of Iowa does not allow transfer on death deeds. And so that's not going to be an option. So you've got a couple of options here because you can't add a beneficiary on the deed of a home. The closest thing is what's called a beneficiary deed or a transfer on death deed, but those are not available in Iowa. So if you're trying to avoid probate, then you would want to have a trust, a revocable trust drawn up that will transfer ownership of your property to your heirs outside of the probate process, meaning it can happen immediately upon your death. It could even happen prior to your death if you were incapacitated based on the provisions of the trust itself. You would name a trustee and that person would facilitate the transfer on a timely basis. It's going to cost you somewhere between $1,500 and $2,500 typically to put that trust together, but it will ensure that you will bypass the probate court with regard to the transfer of the property. Beyond that, you certainly could use just a basic will, although you are going to have to wait for the probate process to take place, which, can happen in weeks or a few months. If it's contested, it could be longer than that. There will be some court costs related to that as well, but those are really your options.
Okay, so if we would have it in our will, that would be sufficient then to be transferred over?
Oh, absolutely. It would just go through the probate court. So you would name a personal representative. They would petition the court. That would start the process. If it's uncontested and fairly simple, it can move relatively quickly. They would issue a court order. And, you know, then your personal representative would, you know, take care of transferring the assets. You know, your heirs would then be able to use that court order to get the deed transferred over to their name. It'll take a little time and a little expense, but absolutely a will suffice.
Okay, very good. That will answer our question here.
Okay, very good. Thank you for calling today, Diana. We appreciate it. We've got four lines open, 800-525-7000. You can call right now. Let's go to Montana. Hi, Thelma. Thanks for calling. Go right ahead.
Well, hi, and thank you for taking my call.
Yes, ma'am. Go ahead. How can I help you today?
Okay. I think you addressed this yesterday, but I didn't catch the ending of your remarks.
Okay.
I would like to know if there's a way to access equity in my home other than a reverse mortgage.
Yeah, Thelma, tell me a little bit more about what you're trying to do. I understand you want to access the equity, but for what purpose? Do you have a home renovation project one time? Is it just to supplement your income? What are you thinking?
To supplement my income. My property taxes have really escalated since I moved here close to 10 years ago.
Okay.
And so I'm on a fixed income.
Yes, ma'am.
And the increase I get doesn't seem to be actually enough to be able to still live comfortably.
And I can understand that.
I own the hog.
Okay. Yes, ma'am. I understand that. Well, we've seen some dramatic increases in property, homeowners insurance, auto insurance, not to mention what you're paying at the grocery store. So I certainly get that. And the cost of living adjustments often are not enough. In terms of, you said, instead of a reverse mortgage, tell me about that. Is there something in particular you were looking for in why you'd want to avoid a reverse mortgage?
Well, it's quite costly with upfront costs to get a reverse mortgage. But is there something like a home equity loan that you could do that?
There is. You are still going to have those upfront costs. And the problem with the home equity loan is you're going to have payments on it. So not only will, you know, can you pull out a lump sum, and is it going to continue to grow with interest, but you're going to have payments that at the very minimum will involve you paying the interest every month, and it could be principal plus interest. So if your goal is to increase cash flow, you know, that's going to be somewhat counterproductive because you're tapping into the home equity and you're adding an additional payment to your budget and you're already squeezed on that fixed income. So I think despite some of those upfront costs, a reverse mortgage really is the tool that, you know, if there's not any other options, you could move and downsize, you could, you know, look for other, you know, you could tap into other assets. If none of those exist, then a reverse mortgage is nice because you can convert the income you have, or the equity you have, to an income stream paid to you monthly for the rest of your life, and the government will guarantee that you never owe on that mortgage, that reverse mortgage, more than the home is able to satisfy. So you could never get upside down. So at the very least, at your death, the home would be sold and whatever balance is there would be paid, and then the rest would be available for charity or ministry. But the nice thing about the reverse mortgage is you're never going to have a payment. So you get the systematic payment or the line of credit, in this case probably the systematic payment, but you never have to add anything to your budget, if that makes sense. Let's do this. I want to talk a bit more off the air because I've got to take a break, but I'll be right back. Stay with us. Great to have you with us today on Faith and Finance Live. I'm Rob West. We're taking your calls and questions today on anything financial. We've got some lines open, 800-525-7000. That's 800-525-7000. Let's go to Chicago and talk to Larry on WMBI. Go ahead, sir.
Hi, Hi, Rob. Thank you very much for taking my call. I really enjoy your show. You really helped me a lot.
I appreciate
quick
that.
Question. The situation is my daughter and her husband are fairly well off. They have their condominium paid for. It's worth about $350,000, and they're looking to buy a home, and they want to stay about $800,000 for a total purchase price. They've got about $300,000 to put down already, and they were thinking about selling the condo. And I said to them, as I've done many commercial properties myself, I said, don't sell the condo. Get yourself a loan on the condo and have the loan paid for by renting it out. This way, you know, they can use the equity in the property as towards their down payment and knock the down payment of their new residence down to something a lot more manageable than what it would be otherwise. They're a little concerned about how that would all shake out. And I assured them that I've done this many times myself. And I think that it's a good way to go. And I was just hoping to get your opinion on it. The tax breaks for having a commercial property, and if the interest rates do go lower, you can always refinance and take more cash out. And like I said, though, I don't want them to get a line of credit. I want them to get a home loan, a home equity loan for a fixed rate. Your thoughts?
Yeah, let me just make sure I understand the situation. I appreciate the background, Larry. That was helpful. So the home they're looking to buy, you said they're looking to pay about $800,000. Is that right?
Yeah, that's probably going to be a minimum. The way things are, it's probably going to be closer to nine.
Okay, so let's say it's $900,000. And what do you say? What did you say they have available in cash to put toward the purchase without selling the condo?
About $300,000.
All right, and they were planning on putting the whole thing against it?
Yes, and they still have enough for emergency funds and so forth.
Great. All right, so that would be, so you said they'd put $300,000 down on $900,000, so about a third, which is great. I mean, even though it's still a jumbo loan at $600,000, they're putting down 33%. Now, if let's say their interest rate is 7.5, we're talking a pretty hefty mortgage payment. Have they looked at that just in terms of, that's probably, all in, 20, somewhere around $3,000 a month, I would gather, between property taxes, homeowners insurance, and the principal and interest. Do you know whether, that fits in their budget? And I'd be looking for that to be no more than 25% of their take-home pay.
Yeah, we've already done that budgeting numbers, and their maximum they can spend is $4,500 a month.
Wow.
So
okay.
They're within the range. Yeah.
Okay.
They make good money. They're
Not.
They're educated people and they're good people.
Yeah, that makes sense. Okay. So now let's flip over to what you're suggesting. So what's the value of that condo?
I would say it's probably right around $325,000 to $350,000, and it's paid for.
And it's paid for. Okay, very good. And so obviously if they sold it, which was their original plan, now they're putting down $600,250 on a $900,000 home, and they got a much lower mortgage payment. But you're suggesting don't sell it, keep it, rent it out. But you're also saying that you should get a loan against it and put that toward the new property in addition to the $300,000. Is that right?
Yes, that's my suggestion. I understand that because it will be a rental then that they won't be able to get, the full amount for a loan as if they had a mortgage, because I guess that's classified now as a commercial loan. So they would probably be down around, I would say probably about $250,000 to $275,000, being that it would be now a commercial property.
Yeah. Okay. And are you looking, for them to be able to deduct the interest? Is that why you're wanting them to do that?
Well, not so much deduct the interest. My whole goal for them is to build wealth. And if they hang on to the condo and rent it, and essentially the loan on the condo and its costs are covered by a tenant, which they could probably get about $3,000 to $3,200 a month for from the numbers that I ran in that area. To me, it's a wash. It's almost like a no-brainer. Somebody's handing you $325,000, and somebody else is going to pay for it, and you're building equity in your condo. I really don't see a downside. That's
right.
What I'm trying
I hear you, but I guess I'm wondering why, if they're ready to be landlords and they've got the financial wherewithal to do it, and you said they do, why not just keep that property free and clear? Go ahead and rent it. Still buy the new place. Put down the $300,000. Go ahead and get the $600,000 loan that they can more than cover, because you said they could go up to $4,500, and I'm guessing it's going to be about $3,000 a month, and then take that surplus cash flow that they're throwing off, because they're going to get a better rate on their primary residence than they are on the investment property for the loan, take that cash flow that they're throwing off and use that to pay down the primary mortgage.
Oh, I see what you're saying. In other words, just use the monthly rental that you're getting.
Yeah.
To add to the monthly payment.
On the primary, on the new primary residence.
Yes, yes, I understand. I'm just concerned that the jumbo loan is going to be so much higher in that regard, you know, as opposed to, you know, instead of being a $600,000 loan, they'd have a $300,000 loan.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's probably going to be a wash. The difference between, I think actually the jumbo rate is going to be less than the rate on the investment property, which is going to be a secondary residence. So they could look at that, but I'm more inclined to them, to get the mortgage the way they were planning currently. And then let's just use all that extra cash flow to throw it off and accelerate the mortgage payoff. And the fact that they're down under 20% of their take-home pay on that mortgage, even though it's at $3,000 a month, is going to, something they can still carry, even if they don't have a renter. But I think they're going to be better off with that approach. So I think one of the two would be perhaps the way to go. But I kind of like and think that on paper, using the owning it free and clear on the investment property is the better option. Thanks for your call, Larry. We'll be right back. Hey, thanks for joining us today on Faith and Finance Live. I'm Rob West. We're taking your calls and questions today. We've got some lines open. 800-525-7000 is the number to call. Let's go to Connersville, Indiana. Hi, Randy. Go right ahead.
Thank you, sir. Take my calls. So I was just asking, I told your screener, I sold my mom's house yesterday. Wasn't very much money. But there never was a formal will. She put it in mine and hers name years ago and then passed away. And then it went into my name and my wife's name. And my brother lived in it for the last 12 or 15 years under a life estate. And he passed away about a month ago. And it come back to my name. So we went ahead and sold the house. But I have another brother that we're splitting this money down the middle. And my concern was capital gain tax. And I was just wondering how that worked.
Yeah, very good. Well, you have a stepped up in basis that happens at the date of death. So the new cost basis to determine capital gains is stepped up to the market value as of the date of death. And then from that point forward, if you turn around and sell it, you really wouldn't have any capital gains. If you hang on to it and it appreciates in value, then you certainly would. And that would be both at the federal and the state level, depending on where you live. Are you selling it right on the heels of receiving this through the inheritance?
Well, we sold it. My mother's been passed for 10 years now. Oh. We're selling it on the heels of getting my brother off of the life estate.
Okay.
And like I said, there never was really a formal will, but the amount of money, I sold this whole house for $75,000, and I'm splitting this with my middle brother, which would be 35, 36, whatever. And I think the threshold for gain is like $44,000 here in Indiana. I don't know. And I was advised just to put the check in the bank for the house and write my brother a personal check and put in the memo section, proceeds half of this house. and I shouldn't have anything to worry about.
Yeah, so the life estate, help me understand that. So it was obviously that's a joint form of ownership where it was your mother and your brother on the life estate. Is that right?
It was my mother's, and I put him on a life estate. I had a lawyer draw it up in the whole nine yards where he could live there as long as his natural life let him live there.
Okay.
And he passed away about a month ago, and then I had to go to the courthouse and get an affidavit that remove it back to where it would pass back to me.
Okay. And so he was the owner solely of the property during his life?
No, he never did own the property.
He never did own it. Okay. Yeah.
No.
So what we've got to determine is what portion of the capital gain you're responsible for. And it sounds like, and this is what you need to confirm with a CPA, it sounds like you're going to be responsible for the gain in the property from the date of her death, which you said goes back 10 years. And so if this property is sold in 2024, depending on, do you file taxes as a single person or married?
My wife and I do.
Okay. Yeah. So, you know, married filing jointly, you know, between $94,000 and $583,000 in taxable income, you'll have a 15% capital gain rate on any of the gains that you have, assuming that's calculated back as of your mom's date of death, you know, a decade or so ago. If you have less than $94,000 in income for 2024, the capital gains rate is zero. And if you have more than $583,000 in income, it goes up to 20%. So it sounds like for at least your portion of the property that you owned, you would be responsible for the capital gains on the gain from her date of death to the sale.
That's what I was asking, because the house sold for $75,000. I'm splitting it right down the middle with my brother, which would leave us like $35,000, $37,000 apiece. And that's why I say I don't know where the threshold is for capital gains starting.
It doesn't have anything to do with, there is no threshold. It starts on the first dollar of the gain. It has to do with your income, and then you apply the appropriate capital gains rate based on your income to whatever that gain is, starting with dollar one. So what was the value of this property that you just sold for $75,000 when your mom passed? Do you have any idea?
I would say $75,000.
So it hasn't appreciated at all in 10 years?
Not really, because, you know, they were old. They just lived there, and they done their day one improvements, this, that, and the other. But there never was any capital improvement in it.
Right, but the capital gain is the appreciation of the market value of the property itself. So, I mean, real estate is up dramatically over the last 10 years. I'd be hard-pressed, even if you did nothing to it, unless it was in a state of disrepair, that it hasn't appreciated, regardless of whether they put a lot of money in it.
Okay, I understand what you're saying there.
Yeah. So what you would need to do is go back and establish the market value as of the date of death, and then assuming your CPA says, yes, you're responsible for all the capital gains, you would subtract the selling price from the purchase or from the market value as of her date of death. And that's going to help you determine how much capital gain do we really have between that market value as of the date of death and our selling price. And then you would apply your appropriate capital gain rate to the portion that you owned. And if you owned it all and you're giving half of it to your brother, well, he'd have to pay, you know, you'd have to discount how much you give him by the amount of the taxes that he's responsible for 50% of the property. But it starts on the first dollar. It just has to do with how much gain has occurred since the step up in basis, if you follow me.
Right. I got you. That's what I was wondering.
Yep. Very good.
All right.
So I would check with your CPA on that. Yes, sir. Glad to take it, Randy. And thanks for your kind remarks. Quickly to Youngstown. Lynn, thanks for your patience. Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Hi, thanks. Couple of questions for mobile banking kind of. Do you like having the apps and working through the banks and mobile banking, and also cash transfers like Venmo versus Zelle or PayPal?
Yeah. Yeah.
What's your opinion?
You know, I mean, they're all about the same. They're generally considered, as long as you stay with the big brand names, Zelle, Venmo, PayPal, Cash App, they're generally considered safe to use. I mean, they all use data encryption and security measures to protect your account transactions. A lot of them share, an aggregator in terms of when you're logging into your bank, you're using a third party. So, for instance, I know Venmo and perhaps one other uses Plaid, which is one of the biggest in the world, and so they don't store your personal information, and they have all the latest safety features. So I think for that reason I'm comfortable with it. But with any of these, you need to keep up with your logging into the account and watching the transactions just to make sure nobody compromises your account, which can happen at your bank or in one of these payment apps like Venmo or Zelle. And so that's where you're just always looking for potential fraudulent transactions, things that you don't recognize. Does that make sense?
Yep, great. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks for your call, Lynn. By the way, I'll go back to the things I mentioned before. You know, anytime we're doing online banking, some best practices, long passwords, 10 characters or more, change them regularly. Check your credit reports. Check those financial accounts. Freeze your credit. Don't use public Wi-Fi. And don't click links on emails or give out information for people that call you over the phone, even if they say they're with the IRS. We'll be right back. I'm so glad you're joining us for Faith and Finance Live. I'm Rob West. We're taking your calls and questions today, 800-525-7000. Hey, do you find value in this program? Do you consider yourself a part of the Faith Five family? Well, if so, let me invite you into a really important group of people that really help us make this happen every day. It's what we call our Faith Five partners. So these are folks that are committed to our work here. They want to see others be blessed by God's wisdom for financial decision making. They found some value in this. They want to stay up to date with the ministry and all that God is doing here. And so our partner program is for those folks who say, listen, I want to stand with you financially on a monthly basis of at least $35 a month or more. And for that group, we're going to do several things. We keep them up to date on all of the latest developments in the ministry with a quarterly update that's exclusive to our Faith Five partners. In addition to that, we send them a pre-release copy of all of our new resources. So, we just came out with our new four-week study, Rich Toward God. Our next resource is coming out in July, and it's a 21-day devotion called Look at the Sparrow. It's an incredible 21-day devotion on fear and anxiety related to money, taking you into Scripture, providing you with really an encouraging daily walk over 3 weeks. We're working on our new study for the fall on the book of Ecclesiastes. All of these studies and devotions will be delivered to your door as a Faith Five partner before they're available to everyone else. And on top of that, we give you discounts on Faith Five Pro and the Faith Five app. We'd love for you to consider being one of our Faith Five partners. Again, it would be a critical piece of our work to continue to bring you this broadcast every day. And it's simple and easy to do. Just head to faithfi.com and click give. That's faithfi.com and click give. All right, let's head back to the phones. We're going to go to Chicago next and talk to Lewis. Go ahead, sir.
Yes, hello, Rob. Thank you. I had a general question for it's my friend. She had her parents pass away. Her dad ran a business, and for some reason, she has not received her, I guess, whatever was in the will or the trust. So the question is, her dad had a former business partner. I'm wondering if that could interfere if the business partner was owed any money.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm sorry to hear about that. It's probably just stuck in probate, which is the legal process of validating the will and administering the estate. It can take time, often several months or more. But if we're, years down the road, then obviously something is awry here, and it's worth anybody who is an heir or a beneficiary of any part of the estate to ask for an update from the probate court, or better yet, the personal representative. Do you know who's been named personal representative on this estate?
Do I know? No, I can't say okay. I do.
Okay. Well, that would be an important thing to determine, and that would be a part of the probate court documents, and that's part of the public record. If someone contests the will, or if there's disputes among the beneficiaries regarding the interpretation of the will's provisions, I mean, those, among other things, can significantly prolong the proceedings. And if it includes complex assets like a business or properties in different states or extensive investments, it's, you know, that can slow it down through the inventorying process and the appraisals that have to be done. So the executor is responsible for settling any outstanding debts and taxes, which may require liquidating assets. That, of course, can be time consuming. So, you know, it also can stem from the executor's performance. So if the executor is not fulfilling their duties efficiently or correctly because they're just inexperienced or there's personal issues or they don't understand properly their responsibilities, then that can slow it down as well. And so I would have that individual that is concerned about this petition the court for an update on the status of the proceeding and find out who that personal representative and see if they can get more information that way.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right, Lewis.
Appreciate that.
Absolutely, sir. Thank you for your call. We appreciate it. Let's go to Boca Raton. Hi, Renee. Go ahead.
Hi. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for calling.
My question is this. I live alone and I'm single. I have about $100,000 in a liquid savings account that I know I need to do something with, and I'm working, 69 years old, collecting Social Security, and do not want to stop working. What can I do with this money that so that if I ever got sick, the government wouldn't take it from me because I don't have any Medicaid. I just have a Medicare Advantage plan.
Yeah. Well, Medicaid would step in automatically, Renee, if you spent your assets down below the threshold of $2,000. And so once you get down below that threshold, then Medicaid would automatically kick in. And if you needed you needed care and you had to rely on Medicaid to do that, then you'd have to go to a Medicaid approved facility. And so there's really nothing you need to do other than just make sure you are well planned, you know, with regard to your estate plan. So do you have a valid will, for instance? You know, do you have a healthcare surrogate named? Do you have a durable power of attorney if for some reason you were incapacitated and, you know, you needed somebody to make decisions on your behalf? I mean, those are the kinds of things that you need to have in place. And I wouldn't be concerned about, you know, necessarily protecting, quote unquote, your assets. I mean, if you get to the place where you need expensive care and long-term care can be expensive, you would have to spend down your assets. And then at some point, once they were nearly complete, depleted, then that's where Medicaid would stick, would kick in.
Okay. Okay. So I'll get all this in order and go from there.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I would find a godly estate attorney there in Boca. If you don't have one, you can reach out to a certified Kingdom advisor and ask for a referral. They would all have a Christian estate attorney that they work with. This is a key part of helping their clients just manage their financial affairs. So you could go to our website at faithfi.com. That's faithfi.com. Right there at the top of the page, it says find a professional. And you could put in a zip code search. And any one of those men or women, you could call them and say, I listen to Faith and Finance. I need a godly estate attorney. And they'll give you a name and number.
Well, many thanks. I appreciate it.
You're welcome, Renee. Thanks for your call today. Let's go to Kurt. It looks like Kirtland, Ohio. Hi, Millie. Go ahead.
Hi, Rob. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes, ma'am.
This is in regards to a long-term health insurance policy that I have with John Hancock. I took it out several years ago, and it had gotten up to, at this point, $29,147 in paid-up policy. When I purchased it, it was $300 a quarter. And I remember him saying it hadn't gone up in years and years and years. And I know everything is going up now. But in the past couple of years now, it's gone up to $388 a quarter. Now, I just got a paper saying that as of July 1st, it's going to go up to $480 a quarter. And that's not even the worst of it. When you're on Social Security and a pension, then in 2025, it's going up to $593 a quarter. And then July 31st, 2026, it's going up to $734. And it's like, obviously, they're allowed to do this legally, but what they're doing is they're, you know, getting people at a certain age in life where it's like, this is crazy. You either drop it or you go broke paying it. You know, as far as I can see, that's why I'm calling you, because I do listen to you every day. So my son was telling me that I do not even have an option to sell this to somebody, because it's not that kind of insurance. That most insurances you can, but this one is not. So I'd like to know what you have to say about this. What do I do?
Yeah, well, it's a real challenge, Millie, and I get that. And you know, the cost of healthcare, as you know, is just rising dramatically, and these policies are increasing along with it. And as a result, a lot of folks are in the same position you are. They're not able to, you know, underwrite these. Once you have them, they can't increase the policies policyholder by policyholder. They have to do it in the aggregate, and they petition the state for the increases based on their real costs, which are real. I mean, the cost of healthcare is going up dramatically, and you're bearing the brunt of that. So what do you do? Well, at some point, I mean, I would keep it as long as you can. What are your options? Well, if you're able to pay the increased premium, then you keep your current level of coverage. No another action is required. Option two is adjust your coverage. So you could call them and say, listen, I can't afford this. So let's talk about, you know, something is better than nothing. And so how could I have less coverage and reduce my benefits and therefore reduce or maintain my premium? And, you know, that's going to allow you to, you know, maybe, you know, these are often measured in the terms of, you know, the daily benefit amount or the waiting period before benefits kick in or shortening the duration of the coverage. You know, so it, instead of paying out for, you know, 4 years, it caps at 3 years. So I think, you know, that would be the second option. The third is you just tell them that you want to, you know, pull out the paid up value. And so, you know, a lot of folks, when it gets beyond affordability, they'll choose the payout option, lapse the policy, and then they'll send you a check for the paid up option. And then you could just kind of stick that on the side and have it there. Unfortunately, there's not a great choice here. So I think you need to sit down, crunch the numbers, contact the insurance company and see, by reducing benefits, what that would mean in terms of your ability to at least hang on to something to offset this need if you have it down the road. I've got to run, Millie, but thanks for your call today. Faith and Finance Live is a partnership between Moody Radio and Faith Fi. We'll see you tomorrow. Bye-bye.